I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest is acclaimed Israeli short story writer and filmmaker Edgar Keret, who just flew in for the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 at the Gershman Y, where the documentary about him, Edgar Keret, What Animal Are You?, will be shown. That's the title of one of his stories. And tomorrow night, seven short films based on Edgar Keret short stories will be shown at the festival. The documentary was made when Keret was on an American book tour a few years ago for his collection titled Suddenly a Knock on the Door. The tour was just 5 weeks after his father had died. Keret has written several books of short stories, some of which have been made into films. His stories have also been featured on This American Life. A reviewer in The Guardian said Keret's stories are at once sophisticated and anti-literary, extremely funny, and slyly serious. I first met and interviewed Edgar Keret 8 years ago. Happy to say you're back on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Thank you very much. I do want to go to this documentary that I watched yesterday. And as I said, this was made shortly after your father had died. And in many ways, the documentary is about your relationship with your father, a kind of tribute that you pay to him as you're on this book tour.
Yes, it's strange because for many years I've avoided documentaries.
I never documentaries,
But this one was initiated by a close friend of mine. And after everything was already planned, my father had died, and I wanted to cancel my tour. I wanted to cancel the film, but in the end found myself, you know, not in a very stable state, kind of going to different stages in New York, and instead of talking about my book, talking about my dad.
But as Ira Glass says in this film, I mean, it seemed like it almost gave you a chance to talk about your father, to mourn him, even to sort of do a version of sitting Shiva.
Yeah, there was something very compulsive about it. And you know, and after that, I've worked and finalized my first, you could call it memoir or collection of nonfiction pieces called The 7 Good Years, which try to document those 7 years between the birth of my son and the death of my father, because this idea of being a part of a lineage is something that is completely unknown to me. My grandparents died at the war or before I was born, and all this. I always had this yearning to have a grandfather and a great-grandfather. And there was those 7 years where I was both a son to my father and a father to my son. And there was something, there was some need to share this with the world and to say how lucky I was to have the father that I had.
Well, what's clear in the documentary is how much you love your father, how much your father loved you. You don't often, fathers and sons have these complicated relationships. And even as an adult, you would take naps with your father.
Yes, yes. It's my wife, in the beginning, she disapproved of that. But me and my father always slept in the afternoon. And I'm too hyper, you know, to sleep. But when I was a kid, my father would say, you know what, if you lie in the bed with me, we'll talk a little bit and you'll fall asleep. And this was a trick that kept working, you know, and even when I was 32, you know, I would...
32, sleeping with
your
dad.
I would be in the same bed, we'd talk a little, and I would fall asleep.
Do you sleep with your son that way? Do you take naps with your son?
I try to, but he's even more hyper than I am. So sometimes he does, you know, and of course, but I always kind of lie in bed with him before he goes to sleep. And we started talking about it, that other kids, the parents stopped lying in bed with them. And he said, I wish you never stop being in bed with me at night. And I said to him, you know, I think that at some stage, you know, maybe other members of the family will be against it. But if it's up to me, you know, I'll stay in bed with you until you're 80.
So just that physical contact, the sort of being able to sleep together.
I think it's this kind of feeling of intimacy because you're in a room and there is no light. And the only thing that exists is the other person's voice. And, you know, and you're in a very close proximity to them. And for me, it's kind of, as a child, when I was with my father, it gave me a feeling of safety. You know, even after I finished my compulsory army service in the IDF and been through a lot, when you're with your father and your father speaks to you and tells you everything is going to be all right, then you actually believe it.
Do you still wear his shoes?
Yes. One of them. Actually, now I have I took one of his slippers and one of mine. They're identical, so I have one shoe now.
and the idea of, and I have to add that when my parents died, I put pieces of their clothing. I don't wear them, but they're in my closet. So at least I get to sort of see a shirt that I so associate with my father.
Yeah, so the lucky thing is that me and my father, we wear the same size. So I can easily actually wear his shoes. And actually, I wear some of his clothes sometimes. Like my mom gives to me, you know, she said it's a great shirt. You know, why don't you wear it? So I wear it.
Do you get your humor from your father?
I think it's funny because I think that every member of my family is funny. But each of them is funny in a different way. And I don't think I'm funny like any of them. If anything, I'm closest to my mother because she has... My father had a kind of a more compassionate kind of humor, and my mother had kind of a darker kind of humor.
Well, you tell this story... Again, I hope I'm not giving too much away here, but you tell a story about both of your parents made it through the Holocaust, but nonetheless had to live under the horrors of the Holocaust. And your father, I guess with his family... hiding in a hole in the ground in what was then Poland.
Yes, they hid in a hole in the ground, which they dug in a farm of a Polish farmer who agreed, you know, to hide Jews. And the plan was to stay there one night while the Germans would search the farm. But unluckily for them, the Germans had built their headquarters in that farm. And they had to stay there for more than 600 days, and it was a very, very small hole. They couldn't stand straight in it, or they couldn't lie in it. They had to sit down for 600 days. And when the Russians had liberated this area, you know, they were unable to move their muscles. The muscles
were sort of stuck in this crouching, I guess, or sitting position.
Yeah.
But as you tell it, I mean, I guess perhaps it tells your father's perhaps optimistic humor, which is, you know, there's one thing, if you could be a champion, why not learn to do it? And he learned to be an excellent sleeper.
Yeah, he said that he was the world champion sleeping, and that basically he would wake up and ask his father if the war is over, and when the father said no, it's still on, so we would go and sleep again.
So, I mean, and interesting that he would nap in the afternoon as well.
Yeah, my father loved to sleep. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that was a way of escaping the hole?
Yes, it was also, it was escaping, but it was also kind of for him, it was a place to be creative because he would dream a lot and he would remember his dreams. And it would seem that in his dreams, he was not confined to all those things that had confined him in life, you know, the lack of formal education, the fact that he had to work hard all his life. So when he would dream, his dreams would be crazy, you know. And he could go and do all those kind of things that he was unable to do in real life.
Kind of like your stories or some of your stories, do you think?
Very much like my stories. Actually, I have one story, not in Suddenly Knock on the Door, but in the Nimrod Flipout, that it's based on a story that he told me.
And did your mother tell stories as well?
Yes. Actually, my mother is more of the writer in our family. She never published anything, but she would write stories, and she was like in a creative writing class for elderly people.
And where was she during the war, during the Holocaust?
She was in the Warsaw Ghetto, and both her mother and her kid brother were murdered in front of her eyes, and she also lost her father. So she basically survived on her own.
And just to her own perhaps luck and determination?
Well, she said that there were a few things that helped her. One of them is that she has a pale skin and she doesn't look Jewish at all. And the other is that she was very, very good with languages. She can speak languages with no accent at all. So she could actually speak German and some Russian and English, French. Yeah, so she could always communicate. She said that it was very helpful because it was more difficult to dehumanize somebody who could speak to you, you know, so.
Did they talk a lot about that, about the war when you were a kid growing up?
No, most of the time they didn't speak about it. It's strangely enough, you know, my wife knows more about what my parents had been through in the war than I do, because I think we had this kind of almost a silent agreement that they don't talk about it a lot, and it's for our own good, you know. It's better for me and better for them not to speak about it a lot.
Do you think that's true?
It worked, you know, it worked. So I don't think I can protect it ideologically, but I've never kind of challenged it, you know. Even until this day, I don't sit with my mother and say to her, tell me stories about things that happened to you in the war. When she wants to, she can mention something.
When did you start writing stories? Were you a kid that wrote stories in school, for instance?
No. Actually, I've majored in math and physics, and and I was supposed to go to this kind of technological institute. But in Israel, when you're 18, you go for a few years for compulsory army service. And during that service, I served with my best friend who had shot himself.
He killed himself?
Yeah, and I was with him when he did that. And basically, right after his funeral, I was sent to have a 48-hour shift in the room in which I found him dying. And it was a very, very difficult experience. You know, I was 19 at the time, and I felt that I had to do something to survive it, because for 48 hours you're in a room without windows, totally closed, you know, with the bullets that went through his temple still stuck in the wooden wall, yeah. And I wanted to do something, and I just sat down and I wrote my first story, which is called Pipes, you know.
And who did you show it to?
I showed it to my older brother. He's like, for me, he was always my Yoda, you know. He was
your
my
Yoda.
Mentor. Yeah, and the first thing I did after I finished my shift was to take a bus to his place and to wake him up and show him the story.
So it was your friend's suicide that, in a sense, made you a writer?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I never had any aspiration. And, you know, and even now in the family, I'm not considered somebody who knows how to write nice, you know. If you have to write a birthday cards or to write a note to the neighbor that he should move his car because he's blocking, you know, a driveway, then my wife does that. Because everybody says that, you know, when I write stuff, nobody understands what I want, you know. But for me, it's like writing is something that I save it only for stories. And lately I've also kind of started writing opinion pieces, but for me writing is for stories and screenplays.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. I'd love to actually have you read a story from your most recent book, a collection of stories. And again, our guest is short story writer Edgar Carrot. He lives in Israel. He's also a filmmaker and writes graphic novels as well. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. He's here in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Edgar Carrot. He's speaking tonight at 7 at the Gershman Y, where a documentary about him, Edgar Carrot, What Animal Are You, will be shown. Also tomorrow, 7 short films based on 7 of his short stories will be shown Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, all part of the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. I would love to have you read a section from the title story, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here.
Okay.
But what we have are we have a writer who's seems like he's got writer's block. He can't sort of figure out how to get going. And he has three people that come and knock on the door and sort of threaten him to start writing. So we have a pizza delivery guy. We have a pollster, right?
And a Swedish guy who immigrated to Israel and was surprised to discover how aggressive the Israel is.
How aggressive they are. And this is a scene kind of later on in the story where these three people are putting a lot of pressure on this writer to write a story.
Yeah, it's like you have to tell a story at gunpoint, basically.
At gunpoint, exactly.
I clear my throat and start again. Four people are sitting in a room. It's hot. They're bored. The air conditioner is on the blink. One of them asks for a story. The second one joins in. Then the third. That's not a story, the pollster protests. That's an eyewitness report. It's exactly what's happening here right now. Exactly what we're trying to run away from. Don't you go and dump reality on us like a garbage truck. Use your imagination, man. Create, invent, take it all the way. I nod and start again. A man is sitting in a room, all by himself. He's lonely. He's a writer. He wants to write a story. It's been a long time since he wrote his last story, and he misses it. He misses the feeling of creating something out of something. That's right, something out of something. Because something out of nothing is when you make something up out of thin air, in which case it has no value. Anybody can do that. But something out of something means it was really there the whole time inside you, and you discover it as part of something new that had never happened before. The man decides to write a story about the situation, not the political situation, and not the social situation either. He decides to write a story about the human situation, the human condition, the way he's experiencing it right now. But he draws a blank. No story presents itself, because the human condition, the way he's experiencing it right now, doesn't seem to be worth a story. And he's just about to give up when suddenly, "I warned you already," the Swede interrupts me. "No knock on the door." "I've got to," I insist. "Without a knock on the door, there's no story." "Let him," the pizza guy says softly. "Give him some slack. You want a knock on the door? Okay, have your knock on the door. Just so long as it brings us a story."
And that's Edgar Carret reading a story called Suddenly a Knock on the Door, and that's from the title of a collection of short stories published just a few years ago. I know you've talked about this before. We're so used to that phrase, you know, making something out of nothing. And you really turn that almost on its head.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, for me, writing stories is very much like dreaming a dream. And the energies that formed the dreams are all kinds of emotions and feelings that had existed inside you. And what you do, you kind of mold them into a different situation or a different kind of plot line. But if somebody just kind of makes up a story, which means that he's not invested in it, that he doesn't have something from him in it, then this story cannot be really good.
And when you write a story, is it an image? Is there a sort of a phrase that you hear or something that gets you kind of thinking this or working on what ends up being a short story?
Yeah, it could be the image. It could be a phrase. It could be even like, you know, like one of the latest stories I've written, I found myself reading a piece by somebody I knew, and I had those kind of vain and arrogant feelings saying, "Oh, you know, who does she think she is? It's so stupid, it's so dumb." And one way for me to fight alienation is at the moment when I see somebody that I kind of look down on, I sit down and write a story, and in this story, this person is the protagonist. And then I'm him. And then when I'm him, I have to empathize with the situation. I have to understand it. I cannot alienate myself from it. So I sat down and I just wrote myself as this person that I was patronizing a moment ago. And in the end, I found how much I identify with that person.
And did you go through a period of not being either able to write or be able to complete things that you had written?
Yes, with me, I really don't have any writing discipline. It's not that I sit down by the computer and say I have to write something. I usually write only when I have a story to write. And there are periods in my life in which no story presents itself. So I keep myself busy. There are a lot of other things that I do. But there are times in which I don't write. And when I don't write for a long time, I start missing it. You know, it's really... It's less kind of like a junkie missing a hit, but it's more like missing a family relative that you haven't seen in a very long time.
Talk about title. I think I can say this on the radio. An overheard conversation that you had. This was the phrase, "Actually, I've had some phenomenal hard-ons lately." I mean, that became a story for you?
Yeah. I was sitting in a cafe and I heard somebody speaking on his cell phone, and he said that sentence, and there was something about this kind of close proximity between the actually and the hard-on that kind of got me started, because there is something about actually, it's kind of such a virtual word. You know, you can't go down the street and see an actually eating, right. eating the grass or, you know, I don't know, or sitting on your car. But a hard-on on the other end is something so instinctive it doesn't even go through your brain. It just appears. So this actually and hard-on, what does it mean right. to actually have an hard-on, you know? So the story, I think, is all about that, about the tension between those two things.
And an example of sort of how your brain works as well?
Yeah, I think.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Edgar Carrot, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, an acclaimed Israeli short story writer. He's also a filmmaker. He writes graphic stories as well. And again, here in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. To join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Mas Cohen. You write in Hebrew, do you not?
Yes.
And then your works are all translated? Your books and stories and things are all translated?
Yeah, to English or to other languages. And my books came out in 35 languages.
In 35 languages. So we're having this conversation in English. I'm trying to figure out how, are you translating what I'm saying and then putting it into Hebrew and then back into English as we're talking? How does that work for you?
That's what I'm doing, but I'm doing it so quickly that even I can't notice it. You know?
Really?
But I feel many times that I say a sentence and when I get to the third word, I realize that I don't know how to say the fifth one. So I have to take kind of a detour, you know, and say something else instead. It still happens to me that.
And when someone is translating your work, who obviously have a greater command of the English or American language, how do you know they're getting it right? Well, getting your words right.
Well, it's funny because I have very a close relationship with my translators, and we always talk a lot. And many times I say to them that I'm not sure enough of my English, but I'm sure enough of the story, so I explain to them something in this paragraph or in this sentence, and then they tell me if it's right or not. And it's funny. But the funniest story about my translators is that one of my translators is Nathan Englander.
Oh, sure.
And with Nathan, when you check his translation, you have to make sure that he didn't add a character. Because he has this kind of thing that because he's not used to translating and he's used to being a writer, so he translates the story, but sometimes he can add a little action or a chair or a description. And you know, and a couple of times I've kept them, you know, because they were so good.
Yeah.
But I have to say to him, hey, Nathan, you know, this guy doesn't exist in this story. You just brought a friend. It's not allowed.
But is that just because he's sort of playing with your language or your stories, or it's just the writer in him, you think?
I think it's the writer in him, and when that does it, he's completely unaware of it, because there is something about it when I say to him, oh my God, no, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. I said, yeah, I know, Nathan. It's not, and this guy's cute, but tell him to leave the story.
What were some of the early stories that had an influence on you, or that maybe even some of the first stories you heard as a kid?
I think that the thing that had influenced me a lot as a child was the bedtime stories that my parents would tell me, because my parents insisted on making up the bedtime stories I've heard. My mother is one of her... maybe only strong memories of her parents were the bedtime stories that they would tell her. And since it was in the ghetto, they had to make up the stories themselves. So both my mother and my father would make up stories, and those stories stayed with me.
I was looking at a review a couple of years ago actually in the New York Times, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. This was Steve Allman, and he writes, an award-winning filmmaker, Carrot is also one of Israel's best-selling authors, a status he earned in a manner that would be downright heretical here, meaning in the United States, by writing extremely short, fantastical stories. Worse yet, they're frequently funny. Were he living in Brooklyn, Carrot would have been hogtied by a pack of rabid agents and ordered to drop the shtick and write a novel already.
Yeah. Well, they do that in Israel, too.
Is that true?
Yeah, well, you know, I tell you something. There is something about stories and fiction that for me it was always kind of like a safe place, a place of ultimate freedom, a place in which I could do whatever I want. You know, that's the beauty of writing fiction. You know, you can kiss all the girls you want and punch all the guys you don't like and not go to work. And when you write fiction, you can do all that. And the idea is that when people will tell me what kind of fiction to write,
yes,
it's almost sounds like an oxymoron. You know, I mean, my agents can ask me to deliver stuff to their houses or to go and beg to my bank manager to do something. But when I sit down and write, I just write what I feel like.
And do you think short stories are sort of, you know, within the hierarchy of writing, a more sort of maligned form?
Wow, I don't even know what maligned.
That's sort of like what this reviewer says, which is if you're a really serious writer, you're going to write a novel. It's 200 pages long or more.
Well, I can tell you that not only in the U.S., but in many countries, people said to me, how about we'll offer you like a 2-book deal and you will publish this collection of short stories and give you a lot of money, but you have to promise that the next book will be a novel. And and I've kind of walked away because I both didn't feel like doing it and I wasn't even sure that I can. But nowadays, I'm pretty sure I can write a novel. But but there is something about the intensity of short stories, about the fact that I don't know what I'm writing while I'm writing, about the process itself, that it's something that is difficult for me to walk away from.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Zach from Fairmount to join our conversation. Hi, Zach. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Edgar, most of your work can be universally appreciated without knowing that you're an Israeli and all the controversy that may come with that association. In what way, if any, does your country influence your work? And would you produce similar stories, do you think, if you were from, Iceland or a different country? No?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Zach. How much thanks. Israel influences your work?
I think that Israel influenced my work a lot. And I often say that, you know, it's debatable if Israel is the best place in the world to live in, but I can argue that it's the best place in the world to write in, because writing is always about conflict. It is always about existential moments. It's always about a different narrative colliding. And in Israel, this is what happens all the time. So it may be at times overwhelming when you live there, but when you sit down to write, then a lot of it kind of comes into the page. And I think that, let's say, one thing that I find terribly Israeli in my writing is this kind of tension between violence and aggression and compassion. The fact that like that aggression and compassion can exist in the same person, in the same room, in the same situation. People who wants to kill you but wants to help you. And that's a strong feeling that you get in Israel, because you feel all the time that, you know, that let's say it doesn't matter if it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the conflict between the ultra-Orthodox and the secular, that it's the passion is there. Are passions of, let's say, a couple who fights, you know?
A couple, yeah.
Yeah, so even if somebody is a wife beater, when he beats his wife, he also hates himself and he also loves her and he also... So it's not the ability to alienate from yourself from the other never completely works. You try, but something kind of comes through.
I was reading an interview with you, and something that you said about the writers that you like, Gogol, Nabokov. You said, I also really like young Jewish American writers like Jonathan Safran Foer, Gary Steingart, Michael Chabon. There's something in the Jewish American identity that is actually closer to me than the Israeli identity, because over there, people are trying to fight or hide their Jewish roots. They have almost something that's anti-Jewish.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make much sense as a quote, but maybe I can try and explain it. What I think is that, you know, that the Israeli tradition in many ways tried to be an anti-Jewish tradition in that sense that if Jews in the diaspora were cosmopolitan, were not nationalistic, didn't work the land, you know, didn't have any agriculture, didn't have their own army, then Israel was supposed to fix all those things that Jews didn't have. So suddenly, we're not that much people of the book, but we have the best high-tech companies in the world, you know, And all our leaders are not the spiritual leaders like they used to be in the diaspora, but they are army generals. So I think that in the Israeli narrative, the diaspora Jews were victims. They did something wrong, so they got themselves in pogroms, in the Holocaust. And the idea was to build a new entity that will not have those Jewish faults. So this is what I mean, that the Israeli identity is in a way anti-Jewish. And what I think is that Israeli literature always talks, or many times talks about the country, and it talks less about this kind of question of identity, asking yourself, what does it mean to be Israeli? Because the Israeli nationality is not like any other nationality. Israel is a crazy place. You know, it's the only country that is based on a book. You know, here in the States, you make films out of books. But in Israel, what happened was that Herzl's book, Alt Neuland, which kind of had this fantastic idea of a Jewish state, became real. So, but even though it's so strange, and even though there are so many tensions and so many obscure terms like Zionism, many people can argue what Zionism means, then in the bottom line, people don't ask themselves a lot of questions about personal identity. Huh. What I think that many Jewish Americans do.
Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Edgar Carrot, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a short story writer. In fact, Suddenly a Knock on the Door, his most recent book of short stories. And he's in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival tonight at the Gershman Y, a showing of a documentary about him called Edgar Carrot, What Animal Are You? We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, maybe do another reading as well and get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Edgar Carrot about writing. He's an acclaimed short story writer, lives in Israel, and again speaking tonight at the Gershman Y, part of the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival, and a documentary about him called Edgar Carrot, What Animal Are You? Will be shown. And then tomorrow night at 7, seven short films based on seven short stories by our guest, Edgar Carrot. I would love to have you, and I know that Kafka has been a big influence on you. Let me ask you, first of all, why that is, and then we'll do a reading.
Well, I was introduced to Kafka during my compulsory army service. During basic training, I would get into a lot of trouble with my commanders, and I wouldn't get weekend leaves. You know, they would punish me and I would stay, how do you say, they grounded me?
Yeah, they would ground you. Is that because you were sort of challenging their orders or questioning their authority?
Not on purpose. Like, I was asking all kind of questions that were genuinely innocent but were enough to get them angry. And in one of those weekends, I found the book Metamorphosis and Other Stories.
Metamorphosis, yeah.
And there, when I read Kafka, the first feeling I thought was this great comfort that there was one guy in this world that was even more stressed and less competent than I was, you know. And my second thought after that was, wow, maybe I can write too. And it took me a year before I began writing, but I think there was something in Kafka that I realized that, unlike the Israeli tradition of writing, in which the writers are very much like kind of secular prophets, are people with the answers, then with Kafka, he didn't seem to have an answer to anything, just a lot of questions. And there was something very inspiring about that.
Well, this story, you're going to read the beginning of it for us. It reminded me in many ways of Metamorphosis. And
yeah, it's very much inspired by Metamorphosis. It's called Unzipping. It began with a kiss. It almost always begins with a kiss. Ella and Tziki were in bed naked with only their tongues touching when she felt something. When she felt something prick her. "Did I hurt you?" Tziki asked, and when she shook her head, he quickly added, "You're bleeding." And she was, from the mouse. "I'm sorry," he said, and he started a frantic search in the kitchen, pulling ice cube trays out of the freezer and banging them against the counter. "Here, take these," he said, handing her some ice with a shivering hand. "Put them against your lip. It will stop the bleeding." Tziki had always been good at these things. In the army, he's been a paramedic. He was a trained tour guide, too. "I'm sorry," he went on, turning paler. "I must have beaten you, you know, in the heat of passion." Never mind, she smiled at him, the ice cube sticking to her lower lip, gnawing her hand, which was a lie, of course, because something had her hand. It isn't every day that someone you're living with makes you bleed, and then lies to you and says he beat you, when you distinctly felt something pricking you. They didn't kiss for a few days after that, because of her cut. Lips are a very sensitive part of the body, and later, when they could, they had to be very careful. She could tell he was hiding something, and sure enough, one night, taking advantage of the fact that he slept with his mouth open, she gently slipped her finger under his tongue and found it. It was a zipper, a teensy zipper, but when she pulled at it, her whole psyche opened up like an oyster, and inside was Jorgen. Unlike Tziki, Jorgen had a goatee, meticulously shaped sideburns, and an uncircumcised penis. Ella watched him in his sleep. Very, very quietly, she folded up the Tziki wrapping and hid it in the kitchen cabinet behind the trash can where they kept the garbage bags.
And that's Edgar Carret reading one of his stories, the idea that she finds this zipper in his tongue, unzips it, and out comes
another person,
somebody else.
With different qualities and different problems. But I think that for me, the unzipping action feels very much like what you feel when you write, because every time when you write, you kind of like unzip yourself and you find somebody else inside, like a different character, somebody who could be much more aggressive than you are, or much more compassionate, or much more driven, you know. So I feel that there is always this excitement when you start writing a character that you want to figure out who this guy is, you know. And for me, this action of when you begin unzipping, you know, and you see a few details, but you don't even know exactly what's down there, which is both very, very scary and very exciting.
You teach creative writing, do you not?
Yes, I do in Ben Gurion University.
Can you teach someone to write?
No. I always say to my students in the workshop that we like AA meetings. That, you know, that people will say, you know, my name is Jeremy and I've written a story. And we say, we love you, Jeremy. We also do this strange stuff, you know. I think that a good workshop, what it provides is some kind of an acoustic environment where people can hear themselves, you know. I don't really believe in this kind of empiric teaching saying sentences can't be that long or you need to have a punctuation mark more often. I really feel that when you write, you kind of, you do something that only you know how to do it, and that somebody can assist you through this process. But this process is totally personal. I think that, let's say, I can't write in a cafe, or I can't write when somebody looks at me.
Well, you cannot write if someone's looking at you?
No, because I think that there's something about writing is that I actually believe that I'm in the place which I write about. And when I'm being perceived, even unintentionally, I become more strained by conventions, you know. And while for other people, you know, they can only write if there are people around them. So you cannot say to people, you know, this is the right way to do it. But you can say to people, I can look with you together for the best way for you. You have to start this walk, but I'll be there. And if you're going to fall off a cliff, I'm going to grab your hand.
We don't have time for another story, but there is another story. In fact, it's What Animal Are You?, where the writer is on, I think it's German television, you know, writing sort of a story for performance, the idea that we're going to watch this writer write.
Yeah, well, I can tell you the true story about it is that the German crew did come.
Oh, they did.
And they wanted to have some visuals, so they wanted to shoot me writing on the computer, and I said to them, I can't write. And they said, no, you can you pretend like you do it. And I said to them, I don't feel comfortable doing it. I don't want to do it. And then they said, well, you know, we shot one like this with Amos Oz and one with Salman Rushdie and one with David Grossman. And they were all happy to do it, you know. So why are you
resisting, right?
Yeah. And so I said, okay, I'm going to try doing it. And while they were shooting me, I started writing this story.
Oh, so you started writing the story about
being asked to write a story. Yeah, and luckily I was writing it in Hebrew, so they were shooting it, but they couldn't read what I was writing.
That's great. Let me get, looks like George from Pottstown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, yes, hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Rushing to work right now. Anyway, the question, a few minutes ago, you were having an exchange together about the ability to write and how he writes. And he described, I encounter someone who becomes my protagonist, I'm impressed, and I have to empathize in order to write a story regarding this protagonist. I have to empathize. And the question became, do you ever lose the ability to write? But my question is, did you ever lose the ability to empathize with that human being you encountered? That's my question. I can take it off the air.
Thanks, George.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Well, I must say that I'm kind of a compulsive empathizer.
Oh, compulsive empathizer.
You know,
you can't help yourself, right?
It's a problem. It's a problem. And sometimes, you know, it can bring out also violence out of you because of the frustration that you cannot contain all these emotions. But I became vegetarian at the age of 5, you know, because I couldn't bear the thought that animals will be killed, you know, so I could eat them, you know. And always when I meet people, and sometimes I fight with people, and while I'm fighting with them, I can imagine how they're seeing the fight,
and how
they have this, they're on the brink of crying, and how they say, this other guy, this asshole, just came here, you know, to make things difficult. And it's something I wouldn't want to give it up, but it's very, very hard to live with this.
Well, I've interviewed actors, you know, known for playing the bad guys, you know, people that are really malevolent. And for them, it's always trying to figure out, how do I empathize with this person that I'm going to be? I mean, you have to have empathy even if you're playing, you know, Adolf Hitler.
Well, I think that, you know, that the whole idea about art is that it's a safe space in which we can allow ourselves to empathize. Sometimes in life, if somebody runs after you with a knife, then you don't want to empathize with him. You know, just want to get away or kill him or whatever. But I think that when we delve into fiction, it allows us, in the safety of the fact that things don't really exist, to really understand how other people are thinking. You know, and it actually, I think that reading fiction and writing fiction is a good exercise for the empathy muscles. You know, it makes it slightly stronger.
You've also been making films, and in your own mind, do you see a connection between short stories and films, or does it allow you to, in a sense, express another part of yourself?
Well, for sure, it's another part of myself, and I must say that the things that had driven me to films, except for the fact that I always loved films, was the fact that it was a collaborative act. And when I started writing fiction, I had no problem because nobody wanted to read it. So I kept my day job. But the moment that I became successful enough to give up my day job, then it became very lonely. You know, you would write stories all day, but you wouldn't interact with a lot with people. And the idea that when you make a film, that not only you interact, but you interact in such a way that in the end there is a film on the screen that both you, the cinematographer, the actors, all of the people who are involved in it see something from them on the screen. They say, this is me. I made this film. This is what I felt, you know. And there is something very, very intimate in this process. When you work with people on the film, you know, my wife said to me when we worked on film, she said, I'm jealous of you and the cinematographer who was a guy. Because she said, I feel that sometimes you tell him things that you never told me.
Interesting. And with films, you get to watch people watch your work, right? You don't get to watch people read necessarily. Right?
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. Because the reason that I like so much public readings is that it gives you a chance to see how an audience reacts to your stories. And with film, it's easy. You know, you just enter a screening and you see when they laugh and when they cry and when they get bored and check for messages on the iPhone.
I know, I hate that in movie theaters. I'm interested too in the titles that you have. What do we have in our pockets? Goldfish, Siren, A Knock at the Door. I mean, there's a long list of. Do you fuss over titles for your short stories?
Yes, I think that there's something about a short story is that you try to take something that that is pretty big and kind of condense it. And in the title, you try to condense this condensed thing even more. For me, the perfect title is a title that you read it in one way before you read the story, and then when you look at it again, the title kind of changes its meaning a little bit. You see it differently. It's just like meeting a stranger in the street and then knowing this guy. And when you meet him in the street, this strange walk or this crooked smile suddenly seems different because they're in the context of somebody you know.
You said you like films. Are there some recent films that you have enjoyed?
I have to, wow.
Pull that out of the memory bank?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, no, because the problem with those things is that even when I think of a film, always in Hebrew they have different titles.
Oh, that's true. So I didn't think about that.
Yeah, it would be tricky to come up with something right now. But I really, I saw the last film by the Derden brothers, you know, and it wasn't as powerful as their earlier film, but it was still, whenever I see those kind of films that go with a certain style, in their case, something that is very hyper-realist and go all the way, it's very, very inspiring. It's funny how you don't, many times when I see people do something very close to what I'm doing, it's not inspiring at all. I just see people doing something, you know. But when you see something, the people that do something that is completely, completely remote, but at the same time, the essence of why they're doing it and what and how art can function in itself is a strong inspiration to sit down and write something or to start working on another film.
You mentioned the fact you had a day job before you became a popular writer. What was that day job?
I was working in construction.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Building things?
Yeah.
Or digging things up?
Well, my job was actually very technical. I would take marble boards and I would drill in them. So they later on, in some kind of process, they could put the metal strings through them.
Do you feel like you're a happy person?
I feel like... Like, my first reaction would be to say yes. Yeah, I think I'm happy. I think, you know, I've had a bad time talk with my son just the night before I flew yesterday. And we talked, and he said to me about life. He said, you know, he said, it is so difficult and it's so hard. And I said to him, yeah, it's difficult and it's hard, but at the same time, it's beautiful and it's surprising. And I say, it's all of that, you know. It's like, it's tough, but... Mm. But it's worth it, well worth it.
Well, Edgar Carr, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Edgar Carr, again, an acclaimed Israeli short story writer, also a filmmaker. He writes graphic stories as well. He's in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. In fact, tonight he'll be speaking at the Gershman Y, where his documentary, Edgar Carr, What Animal Are You?, will be shown. And also tomorrow, 7 short films based on 7 short stories, part of the, as I said, Philadelphia Jewish Film Festival. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Quinn Libson is our intern this fall. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.